From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Argentina for the G20 summit. He has canceled a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He says he did so because of Russia's seizure of Ukrainian naval vessels and sailors in the Black Sea last weekend. That decision came after his longtime attorney, Michael Cohen, admitted in federal court that he lied to Congress when he said the Trump Organization's plans to build a Trump Tower in Moscow ended in January 2016. Now Cohen says the efforts continued until June of that year.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable to talk about this and much more. Enrique Acevedo, Univision News anchor. He's in Miami. Hi, Enrique.
Hi.
And Domenico Montanaro is with us as well, NPR lead politics editor. He's in Washington. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And let's start with this news about Michael Cohen and Russia. President Trump used to say he had nothing to do with Russia during the campaign. No deals, no business dealings. This morning he tweeted, he, quote, lightly looked at doing a building somewhere in Russia. It does seem, Domenico, that his story is changing a bit after this new guilty plea from Michael Cohen.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is there's been some reporting for some time that Trump Tower Moscow was a thing that President Trump was looking into when he was a candidate. The thing that's changed here is that his campaign, or a lot of the people involved in his campaign or in his organization, had said that that had ended in January of 2016. That's an important piece of the timeline because that would be about when the primary voting started would have started. But what the timeline that we've put together and based on the court filings and some of our reporting is that this went through June up until the conventions. And that is shows you that there were a lot of potential conflicts that President Trump had with related to his businesses and the way he was speaking out about Russia. I think the big question for a lot of people is, did President Trump expect to become president in the first place? And was he really just advocating for his own businesses, in a sort of side way while he was a candidate?
But we're not talking about whether there would have been a crime committed if he had had a business dealing going on, or is there a criminal aspect to that?
Well, I think that there are some potential criminal aspects that Bob Mueller is looking at when it comes to President Trump. And I think that President Trump being listed as, quote, individual number one, I think it shows you that now the president is a central person. And I think when we're looking at some of the potential criminality that he may be looking at, we're looking at things like obstruction of justice, mm-hmm. for example, whether or not people have gotten their story straight or there have been attempts to witness tamper. We don't know any of that yet, or if that's something that Mueller is bringing up. Conspiracy to defraud the United States. This is what Trump talks about when he says collusion, whether there was collusion between his campaign and Russia to hack those emails, for example. And a perjury charge, potentially. You know, if some of what President Trump has sent to the Mueller team winds up becoming not truthful, we know that Manafort was trying to coordinate, at least his lawyers were, with some of President Trump's lawyers. We don't know any of the answers to these things yet, but we do know that when Mueller speaks through these court filings, he packs a punch.
Enrique, what is President Trump's best defense here? That he wasn't told about any of this in terms of the dealings with Moscow at the time, that he wasn't involved, or that he was, as he tweeted this morning, in fact, that this was very legal and very cool?
Well, I think the most credible defense would be that he didn't think he was going to win the election. And that's the case for most of his campaign. It's not a small thing to say. I think most of Trump's team didn't think they were going to win the election, and that's why they were acting the way they were doing. They thought at best it was going to be an opportunity to advance the Trump Organization business and got into so much trouble for it. But, you know, being in all seriousness, I think that his best defense right now is that he wasn't aware of Michael Cohen's dealings and how far they went and what he was promising. Other than that, the investigation not only arrives at the White House, but mostly at Trump Tower, which is the epicenter of the Trump family's business.
This morning in Argentina, President Trump signed the new NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement with the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, and the outgoing Mexican President, Enrique Peña Nieto. Here's Trump speaking today at the G20 in Argentina.
The USMCA is the largest, most significant, modern, and balanced trade agreement in history. All of our countries will benefit greatly. It is probably the largest trade deal ever made also.
Enrique, let me start with you on this one. A lot of people look at this and say it's not that different from NAFTA, which President Trump said was the worst deal ever. And he's been talking about all the problems with trade deals, and here he is signing what he says is the largest trade deal ever made.
Yes. Well, NAFTA wasn't too different from what we have now, but this is a significant political victory for President Trump, I think. It needed modernizing, and Canada and Mexico weren't eager to do that because President Trump started talking about NAFTA. We are where we are right now, and I think it's a good thing that the this accord with Mexico and Canada, whatever you want to call it, I think it's better than the one we used to have. It's better than NAFTA, and it benefits both Mexico, Canada, and the United States. So I think we can certainly regard this as a political victory for President Trump and good news for U.S. workers and companies.
I wonder, Enrique, I want to stay with you because this week began with all eyes on Tijuana after U.S. border agents shot tear gas at migrants in Mexico trying to enter the United States. There is a new president of Mexico taking office tomorrow. Where does this entire issue go from here?
Well, I think in the short term, the solution would be to negotiate with Mexico so Mexico can provide humanitarian relief for the thousands of immigrants that are already at the border. And for the U.S. to, send judges to the border to expedite the asylum request process where it's legitimate and called for. Also, in the long term, I think we should spend more time talking about the root causes of immigration, not so much asking why these people are coming to the border, but why they're leaving their country. 300 Hondurans are leaving Honduras every day. And that's because not just poverty and violence, but other factors, even climate change. We saw a crew from the Weather Channel following the caravan. 90% of the crops in the region are collapsing. So we're going to see more caravans. We're going to have this problem for a while. This could develop into a humanitarian crisis if all the governments don't act accordingly.
Well, and in the next week, probably what we're going to be talking about, Domenico, is the border wall again. Is there going to be a government shutdown next week because President Trump wants a lot of funding for his border wall and Democrats don't want to give it to him?
Well, it's quite possible that there will be a shutdown. There are a lot of sticking points potentially in this. We've already had two shutdowns, one that lasted only a few hours, and that could be something that we wind up seeing again. Next Friday is the deadline to avoid another shutdown. We got here because there was another temporary piece of funding to get us to this point. There could be another potential temporary pot of funding that pushes it off somewhat, but there are essentially seven agencies that were not funded the last time the Congress had to try to do this between the agriculture, the Department of Agriculture, Commerce, the Justice Department, Homeland Security, Interior, the State Department, Transportation, and Housing and Urban Development, all agencies that do a whole heck of a lot. We're talking about border crossings. You know, DHS probably would like to have some of its funding, done mm-hmm. for it. There's the possibility of a compromise when we look at the farm bill that's coming up. That's a little bit separate than this. But there's quite possibly going to be a shutdown again next week. And part of it is because President Trump said that he's fine with letting a shutdown happen and wants to play a little bit of hardball on the border.
Enrique, we've been talking about this wall for 2 years since candidate Trump first proposed it. Give us kind of the status report right now. Who's winning the wall fight?
We're all losing, I think, because taxpayers in the U.S. would pay over $25 billion for a wall that's not going to solve the immigration crisis that we're facing. To solve that, have more guard men at the border, a wall, drones, that's not going to solve the issue at heart. And, Mexico also loses because this is seen as an act of hostility from a neighbor, a partner, and a strategic ally like the U.S., 12 million people on both sides of the border that live across the region, they're going to lose because this is not just going to militarize the border. It's going to suffocate.
But what about the chances that it will indeed be built?
I doubt it. I sincerely doubt that this is going to happen. And if they go ahead and do it, I think it's going to be one of the worst mistakes in the history of decisions by the U.S. government, which is not a short list.
You know, the president has far less leverage now. I mean, after this election where Democrats won 40 seats in the House or thereabouts, you're going to have a House that's controlled by Democrats come January. And they're certainly going to be completely cold to trying to, you know, allow a border wall, especially as a Democratic election campaign begins.
Just in the minute we have left, I want to go to a topic that we don't get to usually on these politics roundtables. But tomorrow is World AIDS Day. And the Vice President, Mike Pence, spoke at the White House yesterday in advance. Let's listen.
And standing before you today, I couldn't be more pleased with the timing of our gathering, because just last night, bipartisan majorities in the House and Senate voted to reauthorize PEPFAR, and President Donald Trump will soon sign it into law.
Now, PEPFAR, Domenico, is the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. This was passed by President George W. Bush. There has been some criticism of Pence making this message. He didn't mention LGBTQ people at all in it. But just in 10 seconds here that we have left, this is an issue at least that seems to be across the administrations no matter what.
Well, right. And gay rights groups have certainly found some irony in Mike Pence's prior stances when it comes to gay rights. But the real proof is going to be whether or not the president pushes this amount forward in a budget next year.
Domenico Montanaro and Enrique Acevedo, thanks to both of you. It's here.
You're welcome.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for a Schubert edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. This week, we are looking at Franz Schubert, the Austrian composer who died in 1828 at the age of 31, long before anyone could fully recognize his genius, as we do today for pieces like Ave Maria. Joining us now is David Rutherford, classical host at Colorado Public Radio. Hi, David.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us for this Schubert edition, and we will get to Ave Maria in a few minutes. But first, let's hear some other works. This is a piece you wanted us to hear, Der Lindenbaum, or The Linden Tree. This is from the collection Winterreise, or Winter's Journey.
Die kalten Winde bliesen mir grad ins Angesicht. Die Hut flog mir vom Kopf.
Perfect piece for some of us in this country who are starting to feel that cold wind of winter blowing in.
Yeah, actually, the whole thing, the Winterreise, is about a winter traveler or somebody who's very depressed. They lost their love and they're walking through the forest in the winter and stopping in different places and thinking about their despair. And, mm-hmm. and it goes from despair to even more despair. Except actually for that one song, the Linden Tree. This is kind of a moment of respite in this series of 24 songs. The text was written by Wilhelm Müller, but Franz Schubert's so good at setting those texts to music and capturing the feeling in each of those moments. And so there at the Linden Tree, he says, "At the well by the gate, there stands a linden tree. I dreamed in its shadow many a sweet dream. I carved in its bark many a word of love. In joy and in sorrow, I was always drawn to it." But then it ends in this beautiful way. "Now I am many hours distant from that place, and I still hear it whispering, 'You'll find peace here.'"
Mm-hmm. Now, this is one piece that involves nature. Another one that also involves nature is called Die Forelle, or The Trout. This was also a poem before Schubert adapted it. Let's listen.
Ein Fischer mit der Rute wohl an dem Ufer stand und saß mit kaltem Blute, wie sich das Fischlein wand. So lang dem Wasser hell, so dacht ich nicht gebricht, so fängt die Forelle mit seiner langen nicht, so fängt die Forelle mit seiner langen nicht.
You can almost feel the trout trying to escape the fisherman's hook there.
Yeah, exactly. It's this. It's a bright little brook that is being described there. And the singer is a witness to what's going on. There's a fisherman on the other side of the other bank, and fishing for this trout. And the singer, of course, is identifying with the trout and hoping for him that he doesn't get caught. But eventually he does.
Hmm. And this is a theme of Schubert, just taking poems and adapting them to music.
Well, he was an amazing songwriter. I think of Franz Schubert as really a cross between Beethoven and James Taylor. Hmm. Or actually maybe a better connection would be Jim Croce, because Jim Croce died too young. But Franz Schubert was able to write these songs with melodies that are utterly singable. You know, if you go to a James Taylor concert, everybody is singing along with him. And it's the same thing. His melodies are the perfect melody for the words that he wrote to. And he's able to draw out what each of the texts are about, and you're able to feel it as if you were there.
The next one you brought us is perhaps the most famous from Schubert. This has been sung by everyone from Pavarotti to Celine Dion. It is Ave Maria. It means Hail Mary. Let's take a listen. Is such a beautiful piece.
Absolutely. But he didn't write it. Well, he wrote the music, but he didn't write the words that Andrea Bocelli is singing there. He wrote the original words actually came from Sir Walter Scott, from his epic poem about the Lady of the Lake, who shows up in all the Arthurian legends. And so it's a hymn to that virgin, to the lady in the lake, and that's what he wrote. But it starts out with that Ave Maria in the original text. And so somebody got the idea that, oh my goodness, this would be a perfect piece of music for the Latin text as well. Hail Mary, full of grace, Mary full of grace, hail, hail the Lord is with thee.
But even lyrics aside, it's just a beautiful melody.
Oh, well, that's what, I mean, you're now talking about what Schubert is all about. Mm-hmm. In everything, if you're listening to Schubert, you're always listening for that Schubert melody. In fact, this next piece that we're going to listen to, the Unfinished Symphony, it starts out with this ominous opening here, and then this rustling, very restless motive goes on in the strings. But over the top of that, the oboe and the clarinet come in with this plaintive melody that is so Schubert, it's unmistakable.
Let's listen. This is the Eighth Symphony. Why is this the unfinished symphony? Why didn't he finish it?
That's a good question. If you ever come up with the answer to that, you'll be the first. Nobody knows why. He wrote two movements only of the symphony. Most symphonies have four movements. But nobody knows why he wrote it. Maybe he was emotionally drained after writing these incredible two movements, and that's all he had for that. But they are certainly, if you just listen to those two movements, they are certainly complete.
The last one we have time for is the Symphony No. 9, also known as The Great. See, you're reminding me that there are a lot of Schubert pieces that I actually know and recognize. I just didn't realize that they were Schubert until now. But tell us about this one.
Well, the thing about this one is that what you just heard is something that Franz Schubert himself never heard. In fact, most of his symphonic music, he didn't hear an orchestra play. If he ever heard it at all, it was with him and his father and his brothers playing it in a string quartet version in their own living room. Hmm. He just never heard his own music. It wasn't until long after he died that other people started championing his music, like Robert Schumann and Johannes Brahms and Franz Liszt. That's called the Great Symphony because he was distinguishing it from another symphony that he wrote in C major that was much smaller. But this is the tragic thing about Franz Schubert. Here with his Ninth Symphony, it's the last symphony that he wrote, he is now finally standing on his own two feet, shoulder to shoulder with Beethoven. And then he dies. How much music would we have had he not died at the age of 31?
How did he die?
Well, that's also up for debate. Most people think that it came from mercury poisoning, which was a treatment for syphilis that he'd gotten several years before.
And today, in this country, if you were to go to the symphony, how likely is it that you're going to hear Schubert?
Well, now, thanks to composers like Mendelssohn and Brahms and Liszt, as I mentioned before, now you're going to hear Franz Schubert, but not his songs, because the songs are no longer in style. Now you're going to hear what people recognize is his greatest output, and that is his symphonies and his string quartets.
David Rutherford, classical music host at Colorado Public Radio, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It's not unusual for a former occupant of the White House to go out on the lecture circuit, but it is unusual for three of them, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Michelle Obama, to be out on tour all at the same time. And for the organizer of their tours to not be a speaker's bureau or publishing house. Instead, it's Live Nation, the entertainment company normally associated with arena rock, then the political arena. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll rocks in all arenas. John, why is Live Nation getting into politics?
Well, there's money there. They're looking at the convergence of politics and celebrity, which has been going on for years now. Back in the 80s, political consultant Paul Begala said, Washington is Hollywood for ugly people. That's not true anymore. I mean, it's just Hollywood East at this point.
And the interesting thing is, and we're going to play a little bit of sound here now, Live Nation seems to be promoting Michelle Obama and the Clintons in a similar way to how they'd promote somebody like Taylor Swift. Let's listen.
Join President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton in an up-close and personal live event. Witness a one-of-a-kind conversation discussing the important moments in modern history, how they shaped our world today.
John, can you speak that low? Maybe
no,
only,
I can't.
Only in the morning, maybe. So give us some more details about the Clinton events. It sounds by that voice like they'd be very expensive.
They can be very expensive. It's a 13-city tour, mostly in friendly territory. Live Nation says it's on-stage conversations with the two sharing stories and inspiring anecdotes. For $59 to as high as $2,000, you can participate.
So that's even more than Taylor Swift.
It can be, yeah. The VIP packages are pretty expensive.
And there's merch?
There's not merchandise for the Clintons. They're not out there selling a book or a charity. They're selling themselves, basically. I mean, Bill Clinton had that book with James Patterson, but that's kind of old news. What they're doing is promoting themselves to greater or lesser degree. They haven't been selling out the venues, but they've been getting reasonable crowds.
How about Michelle Obama?
Michelle Obama is a total rock star. She's on a 10-city tour that is taking her all over the country. And she's got all kinds of sponsorships. She's got merchandise. She's got a Find Your Flame and Keep It Lit candle for $35. I mean, this is basically a celebrity entertainment tour as much as it is a book tour.
Is the money generated, any of it going to charity, or is it all going to Live Nation and the speakers?
The Live Nation says 10% of ticket sales are going to community groups in the cities that Michelle Obama is appearing in. They're also giving tickets out to those groups, some free tickets out to those groups, so that those people can experience the evening as well.
So why is this happening? How does it benefit Michelle Obama and the Clintons to have Live Nation promoting the tour? Because it costs them money to pay Live Nation, obviously.
Live Nation gets part of the revenue. But, they are looking at themselves as able to sell out big venues. And if you go into a big venue, you need somebody who can handle the logistics of that. And Live Nation is the one that does that kind of promotion.
And so at this point, do you think it's something that we're talking about Democrats doing it? Is it something that well-known Republican politicians might do as well?
Well, there's only one Republican politician who can sell out those arenas, and he's got Trump Nation, so I don't think he needs Live Nation at all.
John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst. We'll have a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
President Trump is continuing to defend himself after his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty yesterday to lying to Congress last year about plans to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. President Trump tweeted today that he ran his business while running for president, and that was very legal. Journalist Bob Woodward is author of the book Fear, Trump in the White House. Bob Woodward, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, what stood out to you about the news yesterday about Michael Cohen's new guilty plea?
What's really important is that it's Michael Cohen, not what he said that he lied about, though that's part of the story. This is the lawyer for Donald Trump for 10 years, somebody who publicly said he would take a bullet for mm-hmm. Trump and has now turned on him. And so what don't we know that he knows? If you have a lawyer for 10 years and you're involved in so many controversies as Trump was, there could be a gold mine there. At the same time, it depends on what the quality of the evidence is that they get from Cohen. He is a tainted witness because he's acknowledged that he lied. So they're going to need some sort of documents and tapes to really get something substantial. But again, that's a mystery, or at least it's a mystery to me at this point.
Well, and the president says Cohen is lying now in order to get a reduced sentence.
Well, I'm sure Cohen is trying to get a reduced sentence. If he's got a good lawyer and he's thinking this through, he's got to be very careful to be as truthful as possible. This is a part of the Trump attack machine, and it gets directed at anyone who offers any criticism or evidence about what Trump is up to.
We're hearing also that President Trump is in a terrible mood, that this is worrying him. Are you hearing from your sources that that's the case, that he's very worried about what's going on right now with the Mueller investigation?
Well, I have in my book a very long scene at the point when Mueller is appointed, and this was one of the worst days for Trump's aides because he went into a rage, a bad mood, underdescribes the emotions, which were serious. He thought, my God, this guy's been just appointed. Mueller hadn't done anything at that point. So I think this is clearly worrisome to Trump, and it probably is going to be disorienting for some time until there is the next crisis, real or manufactured.
Would he go so far, do you think, because of that worry to fire Mueller?
Well, this is the great debate. He says no. Lots of people say no. One of the things, if you go back to the Nixon case in Watergate, as soon as the special prosecutor in that case was actively pursuing the tapes and got lower court orders directing Nixon to turn over the tapes, that's when Nixon fired Archibald Cox. So a cornered president with the power to fire somebody, like I think Mueller indeed can be fired by the president. Once you get into that final corner, that very well could occur.
I just want to ask you a question that I'm sure you've been asked a lot, but I'm going to ask it again, which is, how does this compare at this point to what you experienced with Watergate?
I think what's happened in this week ups the ante. It doesn't make it like Watergate at this point. It's not clear, and Trump and his lawyers have said this, and it's important, exactly what's the crime? And you need, I think, in an investigation like this, if you're going after the president, you really have to have evidence that is almost incontrovertible of some sort of criminal activity. As Trump says, when he's running for president, trying to run his business and build a Trump Tower in Moscow was not illegal. It's certainly unsavory. Mm-hmm. And I think if people knew more about it at the time, it would have been a big deal. But it's not. It doesn't cross that line. And there are certain things that do cross the line that are very clear. Paying money for illegal activity, destroying documents, or asking people to perjure themselves and lie.
I also want, Bob Woodward, to ask you about Saudi Arabia. The Senate voted earlier this week to advance a bill calling for an end to U.S. involvement in the Saudi war in Yemen. The bill passed, even though the administration lobbied against it. Do you think that the president is going to have to take stronger action against Saudi Arabia?
Well, there's a lot of pressure on the president, and there should be. When you start killing people, particularly people who are connected to the U.S. as Khashoggi was, mm-hmm. then something's got to be done that's different. And this is what the Senate has voted on, at least at this point.
Well, and what about the connection that you write about in your book between Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and advisor, and the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman? They're very close. They're both in their 30s. Does that relationship change the dynamic over how the U.S. administration has handled the Khashoggi murder?
Jared Kushner, at the beginning, it was the first month of the administration, started proposing some outreach to the Saudis. It was astonishing to me that the opposition to establishing this link with MBS, who was then the deputy crown prince of all things, Kushner fought it very hard. The Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense were all opposed. Kushner went ahead, had Trump's support, and the second month of the administration, MBS, the deputy crown prince, came to Washington and had lunch with the president. Unheard of. And then Trump went to Saudi Arabia in May. And this whole relationship was solidified. It's directed at Iran. We all know Trump was so opposed to the Iranian nuclear deal. And I think developing that relationship may make sense. But the intelligence agencies warned Trump that MBS was somebody who was very, very impulsive. And we see this in the murder of Khashoggi. So the warning was issued and it was neglected. And now the country and Trump are paying that price.
Just putting these two stories together, in both of these situations with the Russians and the Saudis, there's this question in the background of how much of a personal financial interest the president may have in these countries. Do you see any evidence that that interest is a factor in decision making by the White House?
That is a great question, and that is the question that Mueller, the special counsel, is tangling with. I have not seen any evidence that establishes a conclusive link, but there certainly is a pattern here. Certainly, Trump was always, as people who are in the real estate business, interested in making deals and money. So this leads to the question of Trump's finances and his taxes, which are we don't know. I've always felt very badly in 2016 that no one got Trump's tax returns. I worked on it. I feel I didn't work hard enough to get those returns, which people in the IRS have said those returns for 30 years are a roadmap to who Trump is and how he operated. And that was a dark part of the campaign that we just didn't see, and we should have.
That is journalist Bob Woodward, author of the book Fear, Trump in the White House. Bob Woodward, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Author James Geary is passionate about puns and metaphors and just about any kind of wordplay. He was a kid when he picked up Reader's Digest and spotted an aphorism for the very first time.
And I still remember it. I was 8 years old. The difference between a rut and a grave is the depth. I wasn't quite sure what it meant, but I knew that there was something special going on.
So special that Geary is now something of a scholar in the art of wit. He says wit is the basic operating principle of human creativity. In ancient times, there was such a thing as competitive riddling. Shakespeare loved puns, as did Sigmund Freud and even Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, there's one story about Abraham Lincoln who was asked to suspend the sentence of someone who had been committed for the death penalty. And Abraham Lincoln said, if I don't suspend his sentence tonight, he will surely be suspended tomorrow.
And how about the one about tea and coffee?
Yeah, so he's walking down the street with, I think it was Secretary of State William Seward, and Seward happened to see a sign, T.R. Strong, which was some kind of shop or proprietor of something, and Abraham Lincoln said, aha, T.R. Strong, but coffee is stronger.
James Geary came out with a book this month on the art of wit, with plenty of samples and his take on what makes it work. It's called Wit's End.
Wit is kind of combining things from different fields, bringing different things together and making something new out of
them. That's the mind-bending part of it.
Because
you're finding things on different planes and putting them together.
Yeah, exactly. And that's basically what the human mind does. And there's one chapter in the book where I talk about puns as the highest form of wit, and puns are typically considered to be the lowest form of wit. But what's happening in your mind when you make a pun is you have two words, they sound the same, but they have different meanings, and you bring them together in a way that's surprisingly relevant. And that gives you the shock of laughter and delight and surprise. When you make a pun, you're performing that activity, but the person who gets the pun, who's listening to the pun, performs exactly the same activity. So it's the same creative work. The person who is listening to the pun is making the same connections as the person who made the pun in real time. So they're both being equally witty. And So what I think is one of the great things about wit is that it's a kind of natural creativity that we all have.
And it's a great way to feel a connection. I mean, you're talking about Abraham Lincoln, to feel a connection. Like, wow, he thought that way, and I'm thinking that way.
Yeah, exactly. And creates a kind of intimacy with your audience. The person who gets the joke or gets the pun is a sort of accomplice of the person who makes the joke or makes the pun.
So it's not like delivering a joke from a stage.
No, not at all.
In this way, there's a synchronicity.
Yeah, there's a synchronicity, and you kind of involve the listener or the audience in what's going on in your mind, and you're there inhabiting that joke together.
Gary says you can find different kinds of wit in different facets of life. So he writes various chapters of the book in the distinct styles to match the kind of wit he's talking about. He writes of verbal repartee as a piece of drama, his study of jokes as a barroom monologue, and there's more.
There's a chapter on how wit works in the brain, and that's written in the style of a scientific paper, and the chapter looks like a scientific paper.
Can I ask you to read, this is on page 39, table 1 of this scientific chapter called Selected Jokes and Puns Presented by Case 1.
Yes. So this is, there's an actual medical condition known as Witzelsucht, which is a kind of compulsion to make bad puns. And it's an actual condition, has to do with brain damage.
Are you kidding?
No. Would I kid you about a thing like that? No, it's a real condition, and people actually suffer from it. And so I've compiled, just like you do in a scientific paper, they often have these tables and graphs and things like that. And so this chapter has one, and these are some of the puns in this table. What's the last thing that goes through an insect's mind when it hits a windshield? Its butt. What do you get when you cut a comedian in two? A half-wit. What did the proctologist say to his therapist? I deal with all day.
Now, those are funny. You said that in many of these cases, the puns are not good.
But these are the ones I deliberately chose.
I see.
These are not from actual case studies.
Oh, they're not.
I took a few liberties with
Literary license. You have an idea of how wit can be helpful, especially in a time like, I mean, it can be helpful always, but especially in a time like this, where there is such polarization in this country. What's the place for wit?
Even in serious times, even in times of crisis, if you're making a witty remark, it makes people, in my view, feel more comfortable and also have more confidence in you as a leader or as a colleague.
Even in a way that's not one-upsmanship.
Exactly, in a way that's not one-upsmanship, because you're showing your vulnerability. And I think that shows a degree of seriousness and engagement that really is the essence of wit.
James Geary, thank you. So nice to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
James Geary's book is called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. This program note now, in Utah, voters approved legalizing medical marijuana earlier this month, but state lawmakers are rewriting the law that voters passed because of opposition from Republicans and from the Mormon Church. That is upsetting supporters of the initiative, who say the legislature is overstepping. Medical marijuana in Utah this afternoon on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.